from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Bags over heads, guns in mouths, electric shock to the genitals. No, we're not talking about Abu Ghraib. We're not talking about Guantanamo. We're talking about Chicago. Will a prosecutor's report on the torture of dozens of detainees by Chicago police officers be released to the public? We'll speak with a torture victim, an attorney in the case, and a journalist who's been covering the story for years. Then, why did Portergas really resign as CIA chief? We'll speak with Harper's journalist Ken Silverstein. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration is dismissing a diplomatic attempt by Iran to resolve the international debate over Tehran's nuclear program. On Monday, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad sent President Bush an 18-page letter suggesting, quote, new ways to settle the dispute. The letter marked the first communication between the two countries' leaders since the fall of the Shah 27 years ago. The text of the letter has not been released, but U.S. officials downplayed its significance. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said, quote, this letter is not the place that one would find an opening to engage on the nuclear issue or anything of the sort. U.S. Intelligence Chief John Negroponte suggested the letter was a ploy by the Iranians to undermine international pressure on the nuclear issue.
Given the fact that the issue of Iran is before the United Nations at this time, certainly one of the hypotheses you'd have to examine is whether and in what way the timing of the dispatch of that letter is connected with trying in some manner to influence the debate before the Security Council. But again, having not read the letter, I don't think I could comment further.
Meanwhile, on Monday night, ministers from the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, as well as Germany and the European Union, met in New York to discuss Iran. But they failed to reach an agreement on a possible UN resolution. The U.S. is pushing for a resolution to authorize sanctions and the possible use of force. The number three man at the CIA, Kyle Dusty Fago, has resigned just days after the unexpected resignation of CIA Director Portergas. The FBI is investigating whether Fago helped defense contractor Brent Wilkes win government contracts. The two are childhood friends and so close, they've named their children after each other. Wilkes has been accused of bribing former Republican Congressman Duke Cunningham with prostitutes, limos and hotel rooms, and arranging private poker games attended by Fago and others. Meanwhile, a number of top Republicans, including House Speaker Dennis Hastert, are voicing concern over President Bush's decision to nominate four-star General Michael Hayden to become head of the CIA. Hayden acknowledged his critics during a brief ceremony at the White House.
In the confirmation process, I look forward to meeting with the leaders of the Congress, better understanding their concerns and working with them to move the American intelligence community forward. This is simply too important not to get absolutely right.
A spokesperson for House Speaker Tom Hastert said on Monday the country, quote, should not have a military person leading the CIA, a civilian agency. Republicans are also concerned Hayden's confirmation hearing will center on his role at the National Security Agency, where he approved President Bush's plan to illegally conduct domestic surveillance without court warrants. Earlier this year, NSA whistleblower Russell Tice appeared on Democracy Now! And criticized Hayden's role in the spy operation.
Because certainly General Alexander and General Hayden and Bill Black knew that this was illegal.
In other news from Washington, a former top Republican congressional aide has pleaded guilty to conspiring with lobbyist Jack Abramoff. The aide, Neil Volse, served as chief of staff to Republican Congressman Bob Ney of Ohio. Volse admitted he accepted gifts and trips from Abramoff in exchange for political favors. According to the plea deal, Abramoff also bought off Congressman Ney, who's identified in the papers only as representative number one. The court papers suggest Ney personally helped Abramoff by meeting with his Indian tribal clients and promising to introduce legislation to benefit their gambling operations. This update on the CIA leak case, a reporter from MSNBC has publicly acknowledged he's convinced Karl Rove will be indicted in the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. The reporter, David Schuster, made the comment last night, a week after Rove made his fifth appearance before a grand jury investigating the outing of Plame, the wife of Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Schuster is the same reporter who revealed on MSNBC Plame was working undercover investigating Iran's nuclear program at the time of her outing. On Monday, The Washington Post reported Rove had advised his colleagues at the White House on the importance of defending pre-war intelligence and countering Wilson's critique of the war. A new report by the Iraqi Journalists Union has determined 109 Iraqi journalists have died over the past 3 years. 17 of the journalists were shot by U.S. troops. The report indicates far more journalists in Iraq have died than has previously been reported. The Committee to Protect Journalists has put the total number of journalists killed in Iraq at 70. Meanwhile, The Guardian newspaper reports two more Iraqi journalists were found dead near Baghdad Monday. A day earlier, witnesses reported seeing their vehicle being stopped by men wearing police uniforms who took the men away. In news from the Sudan, the UN's Emergency Relief Coordinator, Jan Egeland, visited refugee camps in Darfur on Monday. He praised last week's peace deal, but warned about the present conditions.
In Darfur today, the situation is deteriorating. That is why the Abuja Peace Accord is the right signal of hope and change in this situation. What we hope and believe is that all of the groups, all of the rebel movements will join, and that we can now start the long uphill road towards peace. The United Nations will help in this. Humanitarian organizations will help in this. We should all help in this. At the same time, I've seen how badly we need more resources to the humanitarian work. We have too little food now to give full rations to all of the people in the next few months.
UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Jan Egeland was forced to cut short his trip to Darfur after riots broke out and an interpreter for the African Union was killed. Meanwhile, in Washington, President Bush called on Congress to spend an additional $225 million on food aid to Sudan. The United Nations has revealed it's investigating allegations aid workers from the World Food Program and other international groups have been sexually exploiting young girls in Liberia. On Monday, the British aid organization Save the Children released a report about the crisis in Liberia. This is Corinne Zaki of Save the Children.
Save the Children's research found that children as young as 8 are involved in exchanging sex for money to buy food for the family or to pay to go to school or even for smaller things such as a bar of soap. And although 8 was the youngest age that we found, Save the Children also found that girls from 12 upwards were having regular sex in exchange for money and goods.
Meanwhile, UN spokesperson Stephane Dujarric said the situation is already improving in Liberia.
The interesting thing is that the Save the Children report looks at the at a number of cases last year, but since then, the mission says the cases that have been reported has been going down. We obviously would like to see a situation where none of these cases exist, but in the meantime, the mission is constantly trying to strengthen its safeguards.
And in South Africa, the country's former deputy president, Jacob Zuma, has relaunched his bid for the presidency just a day after he was acquitted on rape charges. Zuma had been seen as a front-runner to follow President Thabo Mbeki up until he was charged with raping a family friend. Women's rights groups fear the case will deter others from reporting rape. The woman who brought the charges was heckled as she arrived in court and was aggressively cross-examined about her sexual history. AIDS activists are also concerned about the case, that it might undermine years of prevention campaigns in South Africa, where 6 million people have AIDS. Zuma, who once headed South Africa's campaign against AIDS, admitted he had unprotected sex with a woman, even though he knew she was HIV positive. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Extraordinary rendition. Overseas prisons, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, practices and places that have become synonymous with the abuse of detainees in U.S. custody are getting renewed attention at the United Nations this week, where the U.N. Committee Against Torture is holding hearings on U.S. compliance with its international obligations. But there's one name expected to arise this week that few people in this country will have heard about, and it's the one that's closest to home. It's called Area 2. And for nearly two decades, beginning in 1971, It was the epicenter for what has been described as the systematic torture of dozens of African-American males by Chicago police officers. In total, more than 135 people say they were subjected to abuse, including having guns forced into their mouths, bags placed over their heads, and electric shock inflicted to their genitals. Four men have been released from death row after government investigators concluded torture led to their wrongful convictions. Yet the case around Area 2 is nowhere near a resolution. To date, not one Chicago police officer has been charged with any crime. The most prominent officer, former police commander John Berg, was dismissed in the early 1990s. He retired to Florida, where he continues to collect a pension. Today, a special prosecutor is now in the fourth year of an investigation. Just last week, a group of Chicago police officers won a court ruling to delay the release of the prosecutor's preliminary report. We go now to Chicago, where we're joined by three guests, David Bates, Flint Taylor, and John Conroy. David Bates is one of dozens of men to come forward with allegations of abuse at the hands of the Chicago police. Flint Taylor is an attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago, which he helped found in the late 1960s. He's represented many of the torture victims and was directly involved in spearheading the special prosecutor's investigation. And John Conroy is a journalist and author who's covered the case for over a decade. He's written several articles for the Chicago Reader and is the author of the book Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Flint Taylor for an overview. You have been working on this case for years. You've represented people who said they were tortured. Give us the scope of this story.
Well, the scope started out with one man who was tortured by electric shock and having a plastic bag put over his head and being beaten by John Burge and others at the Area 2 police station. He, on his own, brought a lawsuit in the mid-'80s. That lawsuit we got involved in, and over the years we were able to uncover, with the help of journalists and such as John Conroy, others such as David Bates, who had also been tortured and had told their stories in various courts, but no one had put all this evidence together. We were able to assimilate over 60 cases of torture. And when I say torture, I mean electric shock. I mean suffocation with bags. I mean mock executions. I mean racial attacks, that kind of thing. And they were all coming out of the same station, and they were all headed up by this man, John Burge, who came out of Vietnam, started out as a detective, and quickly rose in the ranks through sergeant, lieutenant, and commander. This went on, the actual documentation now shows that this went on for over 20 years, from 1972 to 1992, when, in fact, Burge was finally, after community outrage, suspended and fired from his job. As you said, he has never been prosecuted. The state's attorney of Cook County at the time this evidence first came to light in the mid-'80s was none other than the now mayor, Richard Daley. The superintendent of police at that time contacted him with the evidence of torture and said, "Are you going to prosecute this?" Daley did not intervene or prosecute at that time. Later on, his first assistant, Richard Devine, became state's attorney of Cook County. Remarkably, Devine, while he was in private practice, had been Burge's lawyer defending many of these civil cases. He then became prosecutor in 1997. Of course, he did nothing either because his clients were the ones that needed to be investigated. So for 20, 25, 30 years, no one in the prosecutor's office, the current mayor, the current state's attorney, no one else did any investigation. Finally, the community outrage was so strong with regard to all of that a special prosecutor was appointed. That was 4 years ago, as you said. 4 years of investigation has led to his publicly saying that he now has 192 cases of torture and abuse at Area 2 and later at the Area 3 station where Burge was transferred to later on. He now is talking about releasing a report. He still is not talking about indicting anybody. The rumor has it that because it is so long that we're going to have a catch-22 situation and we're going to have the statute of limitations invoked by the special prosecutor, who's going to release a report but say it's too late to indict anybody. Of course, we all say that, that's ridiculous, that there are ongoing conspiracy allegations and evidence, that there's an obstruction of justice going on in the various courts, there's perjury going on. Mm-hmm. So no one's going to be satisfied if, in fact, all that happens is a report, no matter how damning the report may be. So the struggle here in Chicago continues and will continue as long as people are still in jail because of the confessions that were tortured from them, and as long as Burge and others sit in Florida and other places and collect hundreds of thousands and even millions of dollars in police pensions rather than to face criminal charges, whether they be state charges, federal charges, or charges before the International Court of Justice.
We are also joined by David Bates. Can you tell us what happened to you? When did it happen? Tell us the whole course of events.
Well, I believe it was October 28th or 29th, 1983, when a few officers knocked on my mom's door and announced that they were police officers and let my mom know that I'll be taken away and that I'll be coming home shortly. It was supposed to be some questions regarding the case. Of course, I got to the police station. I was questioned. I let the officers or detectives know that I had nothing to do with the case. I knew nothing. This went on for 2 days. At that time, it was 5 sessions of torture, starting with 2 slaps and kicks and threats. It was 2 particular sessions of torture that was very devastating, which a plastic bag was placed over my head. I was punched and kicked. And I tell you, when you talk about torture, you're talking about individuals who, most part, were young, had few brushes with the law, but never in a million years thought that they would have a plastic bag placed over their head. More importantly, the torture has never been resolved. No one has ever owned up to the torture. So we have hundreds of individuals who have psychologically been warped, been destroyed. There's never been any clinical resolution to the torture. No one has owned up to it. And I tell you, the fact that this attorney and this journalist has spent years trying to uncover the truth and community organizations and individuals. And we're talking about a city, we're talking about a state, we're talking about legislators who have not looked into the issue of torture. And I say it's a shame. And I'd like to commend these gentlemen for working hard to bring the issue of torture out. But I say it's time for the legislators, the mayor, and individuals who had firsthand knowledge of it to come clean with it and bring these individuals to justice.
Flint Taylor, I remember years ago with an especially active group of mothers in Chicago of men on death row who kept raising the issue of this police commander, Burge, and saying that their sons had been tortured, that one had engraved in a metal bench in the police station, I am tortured, I'm forced to confess, something like that. What about this? What about the death row cases where men ended up on death row?
Well, that's been a major, major piece of this whole struggle against police torture. In the early and mid-90s, the movement against police torture and for human rights came together with the anti-death penalty movement here in Chicago and raised a very strong set of voices, some of whom you've just mentioned. For people, there were at least 10 to 12 people on death row here in Illinois who alleged and had evidence to show that Burge and his men had tortured them into giving confessions, one of whom was Aaron Patterson, whom you just mentioned, who during a break in one of his torture sessions etched in a bench that he'd been suffocated with a bag and was being tortured. That later came out. Ultimately, due to the combination of the factors and articles that John wrote and speaking out by David and others in the community and the work of various lawyers, Governor Ryan looked at all of these cases, and as you know, he not only commuted the sentence of all of those on death row, some 160-odd people, but he looked specifically at 4 cases of torture by Burge and others and found that those individuals were innocent that they had been tortured into giving false confession, and he gave full innocence pardons to those four individuals. That's Aaron Patterson, Stanley Howard, Madison Hobley, and Leroy Orange. Those four men are now fortunate enough, and I put that with quotes around it, to be able to, because they've been exonerated, bring lawsuits in federal court. So there is not only the special prosecutor, but there are these lawsuits by the individuals who have been pardoned in federal court, where we are fighting the issues of torture and bringing out evidence in that forum as well. And there's an obstruction of justice going on in that courtroom as well as against the special prosecutor, as the city has paid over $5 million to a set of private lawyers to represent the police officers, including Burge, in all these cases. Burge and his men, and there's now over 50 detectives that are named in one or more of these 192 cases. They're all getting free lawyers, and they're getting the advice from the city-paid lawyers to take the Fifth Amendment. So you now have the spectacle of, in these federal cases and in front of the special prosecutor, that former and present law enforcement officers, rather than to answer questions about whether they tortured and abused people like David Bates and the men on death row, they have all lined up and taken the Fifth Amendment as to each and every allegation of police torture.
John Conroy, you're a journalist and author. You've covered the torture case for over a decade for the Chicago Reader, and you wrote the book Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. How has this taken so long to come out, though it has come out in parts over the years and in certain communities well known? And now the question of whether, in fact, it will be released, this report that, among other people calling for this, four black aldermen are calling for the public release of this report.
Well, it hasn't taken that long to be out. It was out in 1990 when we did the story in the Chicago Reader. The first story, and we've done more than 100,000 words since. And I think that what's dragged on, the reason why it's dragged on, I differ with the estimable Mr. Taylor here in this, is that there is no community outrage. People don't care. As in every society in which people are tortured, there's a torturable class in Chicago. It's African-American men, most of them with criminal records. And they're just beyond the pale of our compassion. We just don't care. And that's why it's taken 15 years for you probably to do this program, and many others now interested in this report, when the information has been out there for a very long time. The New York Times, I think, has covered this twice, once when the men were pardoned and once when there was a float in the St. Patrick's Day parade that was going to honor four of the officers who had been accused, and the float never came to be in the parade, but there was a controversy about it. So that shows you, I think, the level of concern in the United States about this issue.
We're talking to John Conroy, author of Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, and the Dynamics of Torture. We're also joined by David Bates, a torture victim, and Flint Taylor, an attorney who has worked on this case for decades. We'll be back with them in a minute.
Cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers, sons. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. Touches me most is that I had a chance to work with people. to others that which was passed on to me.
With us. Come on.
We who believe in freedom and that freedom comes.
Ella Song, Sweet Honey in the Rock here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests in the Chicago studio are John Conroy, who is a journalist and author, covered the torture case for over a decade for the Chicago Reader, author of Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. David Bates is also with us, as is Flint Taylor, attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago. David Bates, are you going to sue the police department?
Well, I have to consult with my attorneys regarding that. I'll just have to say that in conjunction with what Flint said and John, this has been going on for so long, and there hasn't been the outrage needed to bring attention to the torture in order to get those convictions. But again, I just want to commend individuals who have been tirelessly working on keeping this issue of torture in the news. We have to look at this as a human, from a human perspective. These are individuals who were tortured and beaten at the hands of people who basically were supposed to serve and protect them. And imagine keeping this thing and not being able to talk to people about this. A lot of these gentlemen went to prison and served long stints of time incarcerated. It was no one to talk to about the torture. Even contacting public officials or community leaders, it wasn't no one to talk to about it. And again, I just want to commend everybody for coming on board with this issue, but there's a lot need to be done.
David Bates, did you hear about this happening to other people at the time that this happened to you?
Well, no. See, the problem comes in is that when you're in prison and you're in an environment like that, you do not want to let anyone know that you made a confession, whether you were tortured, however you made the confession. It was not in your best interest to expose that while you were in prison. You would be considered weak. So imagine these individuals in prison, not able to even seek legal help and advice. I liken it to being raped, honestly. The individuals not even go for help. Then when you did go for help, when you had the opportunity to go for help, people said it didn't happen. So I tell you, when you get rid of all, when you get down to the human aspect of this problem, you're going to deal with a lot of sick men, a lot of sick men that need clinical, some type of clinical help to deal with the torture.
David Bates, when you saw the pictures at Abu Ghraib, what were your thoughts?
Well, the pictures, I'll say this, my thoughts on the whole process was, how the hell did they get hearings and torture from anywhere is wrong. But as we've spoken on, this torture has taken place for over 2 to 3 decades in America, on the south side of Chicago. Why didn't we have public hearings? Why didn't the state legislators come in and do investigations? We actually had to go outside the country to international court to deal with police torture. October the 14th, the People's Law Office, other attorneys, met in front of the Organization of American States to bring attention to the issue of torture. And we're looking for a delegation of individuals to come in and ask Mayor Daley questions that he haven't been able to answer to the public since this John Birch stuff has been going on. And I tell you, it's going to be an embarrassment to a lot of people. But like my good friend Conroy said, they've been known about it.
Well, let me ask about the knowledge to the very top. Some are saying, and I want to put this question to Flint Taylor, attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago, that the report could well implicate, as you were talking about, the state's attorney, Richard Daley, his assistant, Richard Devine, who now holds the top job. Can you talk more about how they knew, the whole issue of them being told early on.
Well, as I said, Richard Daley was previously the state's attorney of Cook County. In 1982, when the first major case broke with regard to police torture, the Andrew Wilson case, the superintendent of police was informed by the head of the hospital, the prison hospital where Andrew Wilson was being held, that there was serious evidence of torture, that Andrew Wilson not only said but had physical evidence that supported the conclusion that he'd been tortured by electric shock, by beating, and he had 15 injuries all over him, burns and everything like that. And the head of the hospital was so shocked, he brought it straight to the superintendent of police. The superintendent of police then brought it straight to Richard Daley. He knew that that Andrew Wilson had been charged with very serious offenses, shooting two police officers and killing them. So Daley decided that rather than to investigate the criminal activities of John Burge in torturing Andrew Wilson, that would, in fact, undercut and undermine, he thought, the prosecution of Wilson. So he did nothing. He did no prosecution at that time. He then presided over the next 8 years over the state's attorney's office, which was complicit in taking over 55 confessions from 55 different victims of Burge and police torture. In all of those, or many of those cases, in the individual courts, there was testimony from those victims that they'd been tortured. However, Daley defended all those cases, put all those people behind bars, many of them on death row, and in no instance did he investigate the continuing allegations that were coming out of Burge's police headquarters that people were tortured. Daley then went on to be the mayor of the city of Chicago. There was, and John and I disagree in the sense that there have been at times public outrage. The public outrage reaches certain proportions at different times. We're at one of those key points again today. We had been in the early 90s, and one of the reasons for that was this Andrew Wilson trial that brought out all of this evidence and put together all these different allegations of torture. Because of all of that, the police department was forced to reinvestigate. They put, this is in the early 90s, they put an honest investigator in charge of the investigation, and lo and behold, he came to an obvious conclusion. He said there was systematic torture at Area 2. He said he had looked at 50 cases and there was systematic torture. Well, what did the superintendent of police do? He suppressed that report. He then met with the mayor of the city of Chicago after we had gotten the police gotten that report released by a judge, and he and the mayor, who is now Richard Daley, instead of saying, now we have the evidence to prosecute, now we should proceed, now we should lock Burge up, what did they do? They not only attempted to suppress the report, but then they went publicly and discredited it. Daley stepped forward and said, these are only rumors and innuendo. So at every point, as I've mentioned, Daley, rather than taking his responsibility as chief law enforcement officer and chief executive officer of the city of Chicago, moved to suppress and to do nothing.
Let me ask you, Flynn Taylor, legally, if crimes are known about and they are covered up, is Mayor Daley criminally liable?
Well, at this point, is he criminally liable? I suppose you could see him as a co-conspirator and a certain obstruction of justice over the years, certainly. But I think at this point what we're looking at is if a special prosecutor comes out with a report and says, I can't indict because it's too late, then the people of the city of Chicago have to look in two directions. They have to look backwards to Daley and Devine and say, well, the special prosecutor was hamstrung by the fact that Daley and Devine didn't act when they should have, and then we have to look forward and say, that's not sufficient, that's not right. There are continuing criminal violations here, and if the special prosecutor won't do anything about them, then Fitzgerald, who is the U.S. attorney here, and who, of course, has made his name in the Valerie Plame case and has already indicted Daley's people in a wide-ranging truck scandal, he has to open his investigation into federal RICO or racketeering racketeering charges as well as obstruction of justice and perjury. And as David has mentioned, it has been taken to the international forum, not only last fall to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is the organization of American states who is still looking into this issue, but this past week and right now, it's been presented to the Committee Against Torture of the United Nations in Geneva. And one of our people has spoken with and presented evidence to the Committee Against Torture, and that committee has ordered the government to respond and to speak to the issues of torture here in this country. And in its concluding remarks, it put with Abu Ghraib and put with Guantanamo the situation of Chicago. And so perhaps there's not enough public outrage here, but the international community and is looking at it in a very strong way. And to hear Chicago put in the same breath with Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib is something that, if that doesn't wake up the powers that be here in the city of Chicago, and that doesn't wake up the U.S. Attorney's Office, and that doesn't, in fact, put on the carpet the state's attorney of Cook County and the mayor of the city of Chicago, I don't know what will.
John Conroy, the Midwest Coalition for Human Rights will present a report that includes the Chicago torture allegations to the UN Human Rights Commission. How significant is this? And finally, why do you call your book Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People?
Well, let me take the second question first. I call the book Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People because torture is always done by, we want our tortures to be monsters, but it turns out that they're just ordinary people like you and me. And I can go back and cite you all kinds of psychological experiments that in which they have found that people will do extraordinary things, inflicting pain on other people, if they are simply ordered to do so, simply following orders someone else is taking responsibility. And it doesn't require any sort of a twisted mind to do this. We are all, most of us, are given to obedience. And so if I've interviewed torturers from around the world, former torturers, and they all struck me as very ordinary men. How significant the international attention will be remains to be seen. It's a unique turn, and it's somewhat thrilling, I think, for those of us who've been watching this for a long time to see it finally raised to the level of being mentioned in a phrase with Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. But whether this will just be one of those media, you know, where the media comes in for a day or two and then leaves, remains to be seen.
And what's the timetable on this?
The special prosecutor is supposed to, I'm sorry, the judge who oversees the special prosecutor is supposed to rule, I believe, on the 12th of May as to whether the report will be released or not.
That will be Friday, and we will certainly follow it up. I want to thank you all for being with us. David Bates, torture victim himself, telling his own story. Flint Taylor, attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago, who has represented many of the torture victims. And John Conroy, who's written about this for years for the Chicago Reader, author of Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
مرحبا يا عراق جئت أغنيك وبعض من الغناء بكى فجراح الحسين بعض جراحي وبصدري من الأسى كربلا فجراح الحسين بعض جراحي وبصدري من الأسى كربلا مرحبا يا عراق كيف العباء وكيف المها وكيف الظباء مرحبا يا عراق هل نسيت سمرا أكل الحب من حشاشة قلبي
البقايا تقاسمت همسا كان عندي هنا أميرة حب ثم ضاعت أميرة حسنا
Marhaba Iraq here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report, as we turn to the continuing fallout over the resignation of CIA Director Porter Goss. In a widely expected move, Kyle Dusty Fago, Goss's top aide and the CIA's third highest official, resigned Monday as the agency's executive director. Fago has been under internal review for his links to the bribery scandal that sent Congressmember Randy Duke Cunningham to jail. On Monday, the FBI confirmed it was conducting its own investigation into Fago's links to Cunningham. Both Goss and Fago have been accused of attending poker parties where bribes and prostitutes were provided to Cunningham and several other current or former members of Congress. Our guest today has been following this story closely. Ken Silverstein's the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, a renowned investigative journalist. He's a former reporter for the Los Angeles Times, joins us from the Reuters studio in Washington, D.C. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Ken, you have written a piece in Harper's called Why Did the CIA's Chief Resign So Abruptly? Why do you think he did? We're going to turn back to Ken in a minute. We're just trying to fix his audio so that we are able to hear it. But when we're finished with Ken Silverstein, we're going to Baghdad to hear about the latest there. In the meantime, we'll go back to a musical break, and then we'll return to Ken Silverstein. Get Ken Silverstein up in a minute, but we're going to go first to Baghdad, to Iraq, where the prime minister-designate, Nouri al-Maliki, has said he expects to be able to form a national unity government within the next 2 days. Maliki said the cabinet was 90% ready and that nominations for the key posts in the cabinet have been submitted by Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish groups. They include the ministries of defense, interior, oil, finance, and foreign affairs. While he did not reveal any names, he said the candidates for the powerful ministries of interior and defense would go to figures free of any ties with militias. Shia militias have been blamed for hundreds of execution-style killings across Iraq. Sunni leaders say the Interior Ministry is heavily infiltrated by militiamen who've been complicit in the death squads. One name reportedly under consideration for the post of Interior Minister is Ahmed Chalabi, the outgoing deputy prime minister and one-time Pentagon favorite. This according to the Associated Press. In the latest bloodshed out of Iraq, more than 30 people were killed in separate bombings and shootings Monday, including at least a dozen men apparently taken to Sunni neighborhoods of Baghdad and killed execution style. Meanwhile, two employees of an Iraqi television station were found shot dead after being abducted by men dressed as police officers. And over the weekend, 51 bodies were found in the capital. All the dead were handcuffed, blindfolded, shot in the head and abdomen. We go to Iraq to speak with Barzu Daragahi. He is the Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks a lot.
It is good to have you with us. Can you talk about the latest? Will it matter, the government that is pulled together, and the latest wave of violence?
Well, the government talk, I'm not sure what Mr. Maliki was referring to in terms of saying that the government was nearly complete. The government has been, for all intents and purposes, nearly complete for a while, at least as far as the allocation and distribution of ministries and so on to the various sectarian and political blocs But, you know, these key stumbling blocks remain. Who's going to get the main posts, i.e. oil, defense, interior, foreign affairs, and finance? Who's going to control the security apparatus and the purse strings, as well as foreign relations? So, you know, other people that we talk to more candidly say that it'll be at least the middle of next week before the government is stood up. As far as whether that government will have any bearing on the violence that's going on outside of the U.S. protected green zone, that's the gambit. That's the big bet, is that a credible government that has key members from all the political blocks can bolster confidence among the Iraqi people, and start cracking down on the violence, start providing services, and bring some measure of calm to the country.
We're talking to Barzu Dargahi. He is in Baghdad, bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. You've written a piece, Barzu, about increasing Shia anger against U.S. troops.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting. The Shiite South, as listeners may remember, originally welcomed the U.S. Shiites were oppressed under Saddam Hussein and successive Sunni Arab regimes. And at the point where the U.S. came in, the Shiites kind of tolerated them and even welcomed them in many instances. Over the last 3 years, that's changed dramatically. And right now, what we see and what we've heard is that the Shiites no longer have any use for the Americans. They've built up the security forces enough, and they've gotten control of local governments, and they feel that at this point, the Americans, as well as the British down in the South, as we saw this weekend, are causing more troubles than they're worth, and they would like the Americans to get out.
Barzu, your paper, the Los Angeles Times, is reporting 4,100 Iraqis died in the first 3 months of this year. How do you know this?
At least, yeah. Well, we track numbers at—it was a pretty extensive study. We track numbers at morgues, at funeral cemeteries. We went to various government organizations, including the agency that destroys people's identity cards after they pass away, and we came up with these numbers. These numbers are minimum numbers. Probably there was more people killed, but based on these numbers, we can conclude that more people died violently and are dying violently now than at any other time since the U.S.-led invasion.
And those numbers are just Baghdad.
They include Baghdad. Yeah, it's, you know, based on the sort of estimates that we did, it shows that, you know, people are dying at a higher rate now than any other point in the occupation, in the post-invasion period.
Barzu Dargahi, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Be safe. As we turn back to Washington, D.C. now, to Ken Silverstein with Harper's Magazine, who wrote the piece, Why Did the CIA's Chief Resign So Abruptly?, on the loss of Goss. Why, Ken Silverstein?
Well, I think it's definitely tied to the whole Duke Cunningham scandal that's been unfolding and the allegations of these parties that were thrown at the Watergate Hotel and the several other hotels, apparently, in Washington. I've never heard that Porter Goss did anything personally wrong. I mean, he certainly, no one suggested that he had any unsavory role at these parties. I have heard stories that he may have attended a few of the parties. But the bigger issue really is with the CIA's current executive director, although he apparently resigned yesterday, Dusty Fogo, who Goss brought in for reasons that were never quite clear and apparently has been defending. And he looks to be under intense scrutiny in this whole affair. The CIA, there's an internal investigation at the CIA, and the FBI is reportedly investigating him as well. He's acknowledged being at these parties. He's also a longtime friend of Brent Wilkes, the defense contractor who allegedly bribed Cunningham with money and reportedly with prostitutes as well. And so he is very, very deeply, he's at the center of this whole unfolding scandal, and he's very close to Goss. Furthermore, several other people close to Goss, CIA officials who he brought in, their names have surfaced in the investigation as well. Newsweek recently reported that Brent Bassett, who was nicknamed Nine Fingers, attended one of these, well, they described it as an all-male party at the Watergate, with Wilkes and others. And so I think the...
At the Westin.
At the Westin. At the... I think the potential fallout from this whole scandal could touch Goss, at least indirectly, in the sense that people close to him, particularly Fargo, have come under real close scrutiny. So I do think there was clearly unhappiness between Goss and Negroponte, and Negroponte maybe just simply used this as an excuse to get rid of him. But it's also possible that somebody said, look, this is getting closer to the director of Central Intelligence. It's going to be very embarrassing if these people close to him are deeply implicated in wrongdoing. And it might be better to cut our losses and get rid of him now. I mean, these are the things that I've been hearing.
We're talking to Ken Silverstein, Washington editor for Harper's Magazine, who's just launched a blog there and has written about the loss of Goss. You talk about related news, member of Congress calling for, saying they'll investigate more than $21 million contract between the Department of Homeland Security and Shirlington Limousine of Alexandria, Virginia. Who are they? What is this business?
Yeah, this is a story that I first reported at the Harper's blog on April 27th. What I learned at the time was that Shirlington, which... it was used by, appeared to be the exclusive provider of transportation by Brent Wilkes, was ferrying people to the Watergate and the other hotels, is owned by a man who had a 62-page rap sheet, a 10-year record of criminal conduct from 1979 to 1989. Shortly after that, he gets hooked up with Wilkes and, you know, begins providing limousine service for him. And meanwhile, this guy who doesn't have the most impressive background, let's say, gets a big, fat $21.2 million contract from the Department of Homeland Security on top of an earlier contract for, I believe it was $3.8 million. I've also discovered three additional contracts that the company got from other federal agencies. And so the question is, how did a company that is headed by a guy with this sort of background get plugged in to the point that it got, from DHS alone, about $25 million worth of contracts? So now Congress is calling for an investigation into this and trying to figure out whether any political influence was exercised to help Shirlington get the contracts. And I think, obviously, the investigators in the Cunningham scandal are very closely looking at what role Shirlington played here, and did it, in fact, ferry prostitutes over to the Watergate and potentially other hotels at the behest of Brent Wilkes. That's what's been alleged.
Ken Silverstein, on the issue of Porter Goss, there was a statement made that he had never attended these parties as director of Central Intelligence, as director of the CIA. But what about as a congressman?
Well, what? Again, you know, there are stories that I've heard. And, you know, he has denied ever being at any of these parties. There have been news reports that have come out. I've also heard from people that he may have attended a few of the parties over the years. These parties went on for many, many years, and it's possible that he did attend some of the parties. I do want to emphasize that no one I've heard has ever suggested that, you know, he was involved in any wrongdoing. He may have, if he did go there, in fact, and again, he denies it, He may have been there simply to talk to friends and to play cards or whatever. But again, I think that the broader issue here is really these other officials who he brought into senior positions at the agency who are apparently, I mean, they're certainly being investigated, and they're potentially going to be deeply implicated in this whole scandal. And that, I think, creates a real problem for Porter Goss. At the head of Central Intelligence. It's awfully embarrassing if some of these people's names come out and are, you know, Fargo is accused of, or reportedly has potentially steered contracts to Brent Wilkes. I mean, he's attended these parties. This is, you know, there's potentially very, very serious fallout from the participation of some of these figures in the whole scandal, and these are people all who were close to Porter Goss and who he either brought in or elevated to very senior positions at the agency.
Ken Silverstein, I wanted to turn to another issue that you have reported on, that you followed closely, and that's of interest to many people in this country and around the world, the peace agreement signed Friday between the Sudanese government and one of Darfur's main rebel groups. It was just over a year ago that you appeared on our program to talk about the growing intelligence ties between the U.S. and the Sudanese government. You'd written a major expose for the L.A. Times detailing how the Bush administration developed close intelligence cooperation with a country that's accused of committing genocide. On Monday, President Bush announced a $200 million increase in food aid to Darfur. Just going to play a clip of his statement and then get your reaction.
About 200,000 people have died from conflict, famine, and disease. And more than 2 million were forced into camps inside and outside their country, unable to plant crops or rebuild their villages. I've called this massive violence an act of genocide because no other word captures the extent of this tragedy.
Ken Silverstein, your response.
Well, I mean, first, I think that, you know, I have to say that the peace agreement is terrific news if it holds, obviously. I mean, the violence that's been going on over there is awful, and so I hope this thing holds. You know, I think what the Bush administration clearly developed an intelligence relationship with the Sudanese that proved useful to the United States. And I think there's a relevant question here as to if it played any role in impacting American policy. You know, there were a lot of, I have to say, some people have suggested to me after I wrote this story that our entire policy in Sudan was simply a function of this intelligence collaboration and that we took no steps against the Sudanese government because of that partnership. And I think that's just too simple. There were a whole lot of factors at work in the policy. That said, there's no question that when you have an intelligence relationship, I mean, we've seen this time and time again in Uzbekistan, in Jordan, you know, Egypt, where you have these close intelligence partnerships, it gives those countries chips with the United States. And so to suggest that it had no role in the policy, I don't believe. But I wouldn't want to simply reduce the entire policy to, well, they collaborated on intelligence and hence we did nothing. The Bush administration did nothing on Darfur. But, you know, there's a question as to whether it impacted the policy and whether the Sudanese government received some leniency, I guess, I suppose, in terms of U.S. policy.
When you were reporting for the Los Angeles Times, you reported a CIA had sent an executive jet to Khartoum to ferry the chief of Sudan's intelligence agency to Washington for secret meetings, sealing Khartoum's sensitive and previously veiled relationship with the administration, the intelligence chief being Major General Salah Abdallah Ghosh, who'd been accused by members of Congress of directing military attacks against civilians in Darfur. And Democracy Now! Went to London and broadcast for a week, and it came out then that Ghosh had secretly gone to London. Then when John Bolton, the UN U.S. ambassador, announced that they were going to seal the assets of members of the Sudanese government, they did not announce that Ghosh would be one of them. Do you think he should have been? And do you think he should be a major target?
Well, look, I mean, he was I mean, at one point, he was reportedly on the list of people who were going to be identified by the UN. This guy is clearly seen by the United States. There's no question. I mean, you don't send an executive jet to Khartoum to pick this guy up if you don't think he's giving you something that you want. I mean, by, you know, he's the head of Sudanese intelligence, and so
We have 5 seconds.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, by definition, he has to have had some knowledge of what was going on. I mean, his specific role has not come out.
Ken Silverstein, I want to thank you for being with us. Washington editor for Harper's Magazine has launched a blog on Harper's website. And that does it for today's broadcast. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.